From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Today, there are about 2,500 U.S. service members in Iraq, and we're out of Afghanistan. These are minuscule figures relative to the 3 million service members who deployed in post-9/11 war operations to those two countries. We're speaking with one of those veterans today about his story, his sadness, his transition back to civilian life, as well as his writings. Michael Ramos served in the Navy for a decade. He is a veteran of the Iraq War, and these days he resides in Wilmington, where he's the assistant director of UNC Wilmington's Pub Lab, art director for the literary magazine Ecotone, and author of the recently released collection of essays titled The After, A Veteran's Notes on Coming Home. Michael, welcome to Due South.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here, and thank you on the front end for being willing to share your story, which of course is not a lighter one. It's a heavy one.
A little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. I want to move back to 2001. You were in your mid-20s, and you decide to enlist. I want you to give us the setup of just when, what month and what year did you enlist, and tell us where you initially wanted to go.
Yeah, so I enlisted in August of 2001. It had been a process to be able to enlist. I mean, I was an adult. I was 25 years old. I was married to my first wife. I had a toddler child. And so, like, there were some admin things. And when I initially decided that I wanted to enlist in the armed forces, my first impulse was to go into the Marines. I know that's bad PR for the Navy, but it is what it is. And my Marines know this story. It's just when I think of the military, the Marines are what I thought. And I wanted to go in the infantry, and I had it all mapped out. And they were like, yeah, we're not offering you an infantry job. So I walked across the parking lot in the town that I enlisted in, Hesperia, California, and asked the Navy recruiter. I was like, hey, I'm thinking about joining the armed forces or in the military. I want to go with the Marines. And they're like, we'll give you $70,000 to be a fire controlman. I was like, yeah, I don't want to do that either. I just want to go fight and be with Marines. And they're like, we're literally going to give you money to go do something else. I'm like, yeah, I don't want to do that. I'm a fighter. I want to just – that's what I want to do. So I went and was in the middle of filing for bankruptcy because, you know, my wife and I had were working not the best paying jobs, and she'd gotten injured while she was working for the company that we were both working for, a grocery mm-hmm. store out in California. And so, like, it was what it was. So we had to wait for that, the court date and all that stuff. And so then I finally went down and signed my paperwork in August. I want to say it's August 21st, but, you know, if you fact check me, that might be wrong.
Let me pause you just for a second. There's so much to get to in your story, and we are going to get there. But I just want to understand the beginning, which is you're telling me you're in bankruptcy, and you're pursuing bankruptcy, and someone is offering you $70,000 a year, and all you want to do is fight. Are you a fighter? Are you somebody who there's a disconnect there?
Yeah, I'm not a professional boxer by any means, but like I've always just been kind of I love a good argument and I love a good fight just as much as some people do. Although I'm finding out that very few people do enjoy those things, but that's just what I wanted to do. The $90,000 job was to be a nuclear technician, and I've got friends of mine who did that. I didn't want to sit under the water in a submarine working on nuclear reactors. That just wasn't my thing.
Okay.
And then the other job that they had offered me was a fire controlman. The recruiter boiled it down to the civilian me was like, I just pushed the button on the cruise missiles. And I was like, I don't want to sit on a ship and like, if there's going to be a fight. And of course, there was no fighting. There was no war at this point. The Cole had happened October 12th, 2000, but there wasn't an actual war yet. But in my mind, the military was, you go to fight. That's what I wanted to do. I don't want to do these other jobs. I want to do the dirty jobs. I want to be out on the ground. I want to do those kinds of things. And the jobs that the Navy really only had a couple of jobs at the time. I didn't know anything about SEALs. I was not fit enough to be a SEAL anyways.
Let me just drop a little bit of context in there before we go too far on from USS Cole. You mentioned the USS Cole, which I think might come up again in our conversation. May not, but the USS Cole was an American naval ship that was taken down by Al-Qaeda forces in October of 2000. It was a suicide bombing. And that was something that sparked you to want to pursue this Navy path or this military path, initially a Marine path, in your mid-20s. So you enlist in late August of 2001. And of course, just weeks later, there is this seminal day, this monumental day with this multi-pronged attack on our country, September 11th, 2001. And for you, that made you reassess there in the very initial moment about what you wanted to be doing? And then you call your recruiter. You talk about this in your book. Yeah.
So on 9/11, I was getting ready to go work at my job at the church that I was working at then. And it was right around 6:30 or whatever it was on the East Coast. And my son was about a year or two old. And I had just gotten out of the shower. My first wife's like, honey, you need to come take a look at this. And I remember walking into the living room just as one of the planes hit the towers. And I was like, whoa, what a cool, realistic movie this is. What's going on? And she's like, no, that's not a movie. Somebody just hit the Twin Towers. And that was the second plane that hit, I think. And so she was like, I think the news is saying that we got attacked. And so, yeah, I called up my recruiter. It was Brad something or other. And I was like, yeah, so like I didn't want to be in the Navy in the first place. I wanted to be in the Marines. I wanted to go in the infantry, and they didn't have any infantry spaces. Can I get out of my contract so I can go in the infantry? And he was like, no, we're keeping you. You're going to go to boot camp. And I shipped to boot camp October 23rd of 2001. And so I had to wait like another month and change. And I was pretty impatient. But it was what it was. And that was the way it worked. But I was ready to get in. I was ready to get into the fight. And that's not what the universe had in store for me. So
Michael Ramos here with us on Due South. He is an Iraq War veteran, and he is the author of a new book. It's a collection of essays that he wrote after coming back from the Middle East. He was honorably discharged in 2010. And we're going to talk about his book here in a little bit. But first, I want to talk about the role that you did have. Colloquially, it's an RP. Mm-hmm. What is an RP, and what does an RP do?
So an RP is a religious program specialist, is what the job's title is called. And basically, I was an assistant slash bodyguard for Navy chaplains. The way the U.S. military works is clergy are not allowed to carry weapons by U.S. code. And the Geneva Conventions labels them as non-combatants. But they are still targets, and they still need protection. So rather than detail a Marine to do it, when a chaplain gets assigned to the Marines, because the Marines don't have medical personnel or naval personnel. That's what the Navy's for. And they all hate this, but they are, in fact, a Department of the Navy. And that's why we provide that for them. And so that's the job I chose, and that's what I did. RP is just what my title was. My rank was anywhere from RPSN, which is very little rank, as an E3, to RP1, which is the rank that I got out at.
All right, RP, short for Religious Program Specialist. Mm-hmm. First of all, is that what you did during your decade? Was there anything else? You were an RP from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Paint the picture a little bit further for us. How many firearms are you carrying? Are you with a chaplain 12 hours a day, 18 hours a day? Are you inside of the wire? Are you in the red zone? Just go next level for us, please.
So, yeah, sure. Although I will say I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this part, but I will for context, right? So it depends on where. So when I was in Iraq, I was with the chaplain 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We were in the invasion, so there was no green zone, red zone. There were no wires. It was you were in a hostile country, varying levels of hostility. I carried a pistol and I carried a rifle, an M16 A4, or it might have been an A2, the M9 Beretta service pistol. And then I was known, like my Marines, I had like 15 knives or something, like it was like five knives on me at all
sure.
times, a little baby K-bar and a couple of pocket knives, which really sounds like I'm really super cool. Really, it was just to open MREs and stuff like that, mundane tasks.
But those mundane tasks, you are seeking to protect the chaplain, to keep mm-hmm. him or her safe. Are there couple of questions here. One, are there any female chaplains? This
yeah.
is my ignorance shining through. And two, what are some of the basic functions of the duty that you're carrying out during those 24-hour, 7-day-a-week things?
Yeah. So, yes, there are female chaplains. There's quite a lot of them. In the Navy, there were chaplains of all faiths. Even like right towards the end of my career, I think we even had like a Wiccan, maybe. I heard some scuttlebutt. Most of the ones I worked with were rabbis, priests, Catholic priests, and then Protestant ministers. When I was on active duty and especially when I was in in Iraq in 2003, there were no female chaplains in combat units or in frontline units. There were female RPs, but we didn't have any female chaplains that I can remember, unless there might have been one MLG or group. I'd have to check with one of my friends. But so their job was just to do chaplain things, which is provide counsel, do services. And my job was to help set up services and then also protect the chaplain. That's the open-ended, nice way of saying I was either a bullet sponge and was supposed to take one for the chaplain, which none of us were ever going to do, or I had put enough rounds downrange to keep the chaplain from getting killed. and myself and my Marines.
What's the most common misconception that people like me, civilians who never served in the military, have about people like you who did, that we could maybe cut out or try to cut out?
Yeah, so there's two that are tied. One is that we're all of us on the frontline warfighters. Actual trigger pullers are like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of our percentage. Most of us are support. I supported the chaplain. Yeah, my job was to carry weapons around. Yeah, okay, yeah, I have a combat action ribbon, but like that's not the vast majority of us. We do far more cleanup and admin, like regular people jobs, than we do the sexy, cool jobs that everybody thinks we are doing. The second is that not all of us who deployed have PTSD or are broken. Like, that's just not a thing. Like, and it goes back to the, like, I mean, we're not at war again. So, like, when people see some freshly minted boot at the airport and they're like, oh, well, thank you for your service. That dude's been in for like 7 minutes. Like, what are you really thanking that kid for? Is it a reflex, or are you really interested in what he signed up to do?
Michael Ramos is here with us on Due South. These days, he's the assistant director of UNC Wilmington's Pub Lab. He's also the art director for the literary magazine Ecotone, and he's the author of a new book. It's a collection of essays that he scribed titled The After, A Veteran's Notes on Coming Home. On the other side, we will chat with Michael about coming home. Some of his colleagues came home prior to when they wanted to, and he sent them off in boxes. We'll talk about one of his essays titled Boxes on the Other Side, and also learn about his journey back into civilian life here in North Carolina. Stay tuned. This is Due South on listener-supported North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Welcome back. It's Due South. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Michael Ramos is your guest this hour. He is an Iraq War veteran, and he joins us from WHQR in Wilmington, where he's on the line sharing a reflection of his experiences in the Middle East and also his book. It's a collection of essays that is recently out. It is titled The After, A Veteran's Notes on Coming Home. I'm not interested in the gory or the hyperbolic or the sensational, but I do want to get a sense of, from you being on the front lines, just how heavy, just how dark, just how, I'm literally throwing my palms up to you on the Zoom, and I want you to take it where you want to take it. But that time, Operation Iraqi Freedom, I believe was the name of the mission, yeah. Almost 20 years ago, or yeah, more than 20 years ago now.
21 years ago, March 19th.
Describe it for us, please.
It was really cold when I got there. So it's really interesting. Like, we landed in Kuwait first. We were out in the middle of nowhere at LSA Matilda. I ended up going back to Matilda in 2007 or 8, and it was not the place I remember. There's a show called Generation Kill on HBO that takes place in Matilda, which is really funny because the recon guys lived like three tents down from us, and some of my Marines that were engineers were attached to them. And that show is kind of inaccurate. Like, they paint the stereotypical picture of what a Marine base was like. There were no guard towers, there were no wire. It was just open sand for miles and miles and miles. You couldn't see anything. There was a lot of waiting and training and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to see whether the diplomatic mission would succeed. And if the diplomatic mission succeeded, we were just going to go home. And we were hoping that was the way it was going to be. And when you're in those kinds of areas, it's the weirdest thing. There's like this weird disconnect where part of you, you're a young man, you're full of bravado, you're ready to go do the thing that men do, and like you're ready to go to war, but also you're like, or we could just go home. That'd be fine too. And so it's one of those things where you're just kind of waiting. And then once we started, we moved into position, we launched the war. There was a lot of air and artillery that went forward. One of my Marines, PFC Dowler, was the first Marine over the berm, is what we called it. He was a combat engineer. He breached the obstacles and then led his unit across. We were a couple kilometers behind him. And then we just all pushed through. There was a lot of sand and a lot of sitting in the back of open truck Humvees or open Humvees with, like, we didn't have, like, when people think about the Iraq War, they think a lot of times about all the armor that we ended up wearing, all the up-armored Humvees. We didn't have any of that. Like, our uniforms didn't match. We were wearing green mop suits in the middle of the desert. We hadn't gotten to the Euphrates River Valley, which is actually quite green and very humid. We were all really surprised about that. But we just, it was like some of the Marines were wearing the digital camis, which are now the uniform. But some of us still had the old school tricolors, mismatched parts, interceptor vests, not enough sappy plates to go around. Yeah. It's really funny, but if you do a lot of reading about history, the United States has been unprepared for every war that it's been involved in. And the same was true. We didn't have enough gear. We didn't have the right gear. We were just like, well, we'll figure it out on the way. And we just figured it out on the way, drove up to Baghdad, did the thing, and came home. For me, the war was pretty easy. Some of my friends, the war was more like what you would think a war was. Mm-hmm.
How long were you there?
Let's see. Well, so from March 19th in Iraq up until like the end of May, we got to Kuwait in January. So then, and then we ended up taking the Bonham Richard home. And so I was gone maybe till mid-July, late July.
Okay. I want to talk about one of the essays. We're going to kind of dip into a couple of the different essays that you have written for your new book. I want to ask you first about one called Boxes.
Mm-hmm.
What is this essay about in just a few sentences?
This essay is about all the boxes that I came across in the military. This was one of the first essays I had written. It was one of the very first essays I'd ever published as an undergraduate. It's the oldest. Boxes and Boots are actually the two oldest essays in the book. And they're both out of the same time period. My TA at UNCW's creative writing department was Josh Anderson at the time, and his writing prompt was go to the Sun's website, go to Reader's Write. There's a list of topics. Choose one, write it. And I saw boxes and I was like, oh, dude, I could totally think about my military career through all the boxes I had encountered. And that appealed to me in the creative part of me and the way my brain works. I got really excited about that. So I just wrote it. One of the things that, and the whole thing about the whole theme of the book is that getting tired of the trite, oh, this is what the military was like, this is what it must have been like for you, we went over there, this is what happened. We've been doing that for thousands of years. That's not interesting to me. But what was interesting to me is looking at my career through all the boxes that I had encountered on deployment and moving, and I had just come from a move where TMO, Transportation Management Office, had boxed up all my stuff when I was getting ready to go back to the civilian world. I was like, oh, this would be a really interesting essay. So I just wrote the essay Boxes based off of that.
Okay. So some of this is basic, as you might think, boxes, right? Oh, yeah, it's a box lunch. It's a box of your crap that's got to be sent back home or sent over. Okay. I'm going to read a paragraph here. I've got a question for you, and I'm going to have you read from Boxes here in a moment. But this is a portion of the essay Boxes. Other times we slept in boxes, dug into the ground. One man fighting positions, ranger graves. No one used the fancy names, just graves or holes. The boxes were dug deep enough for us to lie in at night and to protect us from IDF. The boxes also had the benefit of being ready-made holes in case we got killed, we all joked. It strikes me that you're close to death in this setting, in a war, and also that perhaps you're holding humor close as well. Talk to me about kind of the intersection, because this essay struck me for a number of reasons, but that particular line struck me. Talk to me about the intersection of death and humor, and perhaps which one you're holding more closely.
Probably humor is the one that I'm definitely holding more closely to, and a lot of us do, I would think. I don't want to be presumptive and speak for everybody, but it's one of those things where the human psyche can't grasp, especially when we're that young, right? Like, most of us are under the age of 30. Death is real, but it's not really real. It's a concept. We all know people die, but like, I'm probably not going to die. Like, it's just this thing, right? But we don't know how to really draw near to it and handle it. And so the way that we handle it and the way that warfighters have done this for thousands of, again, literal thousands of years, is to use dark humor to make it more palatable, to make it less serious, make it less scary, I think.
Mm-hmm.
and to make it something that's manageable without breaking us. Like I remember an essay that I wrote or I tried to write a scene about, and I couldn't get it to land. So it didn't make it into this book. And it is the day I had to go down to legal and write my own will. And, you know, I'm 26 years old at the time. I've got a toddler and a young wife, but we don't have a whole lot of things. Like I'm going to, and when we do our SGLI, our life insurance, they already tell you to designate your beneficiaries. So like, what else am I going to do? Like, and I started thinking about like, my son is a Marine. He's out now, but when he had to go on deployment, they probably made him do his will. And like all of my friends, I was the old man in the platoon always. Like, so most of my friends were between 18 and 22. Like, what are they going to, like, they have to write their wills too. Like, and that's the point where you know that you're playing for real keeps. Like, but like, what are they going to do? Their video game system, their clothes, like, so, but you can't think about that all the time. So you just develop this dark sense of humor to help you cope with it. And that was one of those things where like, yeah, man, well, at least if I get killed, I'm already in the hole. I don't have to worry about it. And we all just kind of make jokes about that. It's the way you take the edge off, I think.
If you've got a copy of your book handy, I'm going to ask you to turn to page 9. And this is a portion of boxes that I would like for you to read. It's about halfway down page 9, at least on the iteration that I have. I don't know if it's formatted differently for you. It begins, "We really do."
Yeah, I have my book here, so. "We really do box people up and ship them home if they die in a combat zone, just like the cadence says. Before Marines get boxed up, the truth is, sometimes their Marines have to go collect the parts of their buddies and put them in bags so they can be shipped to the rear to be boxed up in a nice coffin and covered with a flag. Then some Marine, or maybe a doc or an RP, who is also friends with that Marine, has to go and box up and inventory the belongings of the Marine who got killed. The box the Marine goes in gets covered in an American flag, and then that box gets lowered into the ground while Taps plays, and moms and wives and little brothers and dads and sisters sob. Sometimes we might have tears, too. I don't like to think about how many people I know in boxes and how many boxes I've seen lowered into the ground. I hate those boxes. These things sound outrageous and horrible. They are all within the box the CO mentioned earlier."
Respectfully, I read that, and the first part of that passage struck me as being so void, and I imagine by design, of any personal emotion. You're talking about this box. You're talking about these people that are going into these boxes, even if it's pieces of the people. Was that by design?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm a literary writer. So for me, I think a lot about poetry. I think a lot about attitude and mood and technique and sentences. And one of the things that I was trying to get at was my mindset at the time, where this is just the job and it is what it is. And so you have to be able to divorce yourself from the realities of it, or you crack, right? And so then the question is, how do I capture that on the page instead of coming apart? And the other part of it too is thinking about like writing these things is really difficult. And this is something I talk with a lot about my graduate students when I talk about writing. It's like, how do we write the difficult, traumatic, horrible things that happened to us or that we saw happen? And part of it is in the telling of the thing, not the thing itself. And so thinking about, how do I render this on the page to capture my mindset and help my reader see where I was at that point in time? And so using these things in a very basic, business-like, emotionally void terminology, because that's, if you, the first line of the essay is, the second line is, "This is the box the CO said at a staff meeting. The Marines shouldn't be getting awards if they're operating in the box. So this is just what we do. It's who we are. There's no anything attached to it." And so it's thinking about consistency of narrative voice. It's how the narrator is moving through that time.
But that compartmentalization and that divorcing from what I'll call it, an internal storm, is that permanent? Is that in perpetuity?
No. When you're on the job, when you're overseas downrange, then it kind of is. Yeah, you can't allow yourself to start thinking about things like that, because then you can crack up. And if you're in a combat arms job and you crack up, somebody's going to get hurt. And if they get hurt, they're probably going to go home in a box. Like that's the real realities of it. But when you think about, and that's part of the coming home, is that then you have time and distance and you can kind of decompress. You can start thinking about these things. You can have these, oh my gosh, moments. Like I had a buddy of mine who retired, and we were just talking about all the, we were just counting up all the times we almost died. And you actually have to sit and think about it. And then there's that moment when you're like, oh man, there's a high number of times that I almost died. And I wasn't even like a regular infantryman. I'm not an infantryman. I wasn't on the front lines. I'm not a special operator. I wasn't in harm's way at the length that some of my other friends were in harm's way. And I still have a fairly large amount of times I almost got killed, right? And so you think about that and you're like, wow. And then it's one of those things where as you evolve as a human, as you move in the world, then you realize that you have to go back and grapple with these things. And for me as a writer especially, and I know lots of people who don't grapple with those things, but for me as a writer and what I want to do with the book, grappling with those things later, and as you see, and the way my narrator changes throughout the arc of the book, he's much more personal. He is able to think about these things. This early stage voice changes as the essays collect and move forward in momentum.
Michael Ramos is your guest here on Due South. His new book, The After, A Veteran's Notes on Coming Home, is a collection of essays that he has written following his decade-long career in the Navy. Can I say career, even though it's only a decade? Just making sure. So I want to run it back to you. I mean, I heard what you just said, but it's a microcosm of your path, right? Like your development as a human, as somebody who dealt with varying degrees of trauma. You dealt with the trauma you dealt with coming back from Iraq, but I suppose there are varying degrees of trauma depending on what you have seen on the front lines. And as we think about this arc, as we think about the different voice, your different voices from first essay to latter essays in the book, is writing, by and large, to receive the credit for what moved you along? Is it deep therapy? Is it having those conversations with other former veterans where you sit down over whatever, a coffee or a beer, and you realize, holy, we almost died 38 times or 7 times or whatever it may have been?
Yeah.
How do you get there?
So for me as a writer, it's all about telling a good story, right? Anybody can tell a story, right? Anybody can say, I went to war and this is what happened and then I came home and the end. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote my book and the way I wrote my book for that very reason. I've said this so many times, I'm getting tired of hearing myself tell it. But I think it bears retelling here is that people have been telling war stories for literal thousands of years. Some of the oldest pieces of literature are, in the West, we can think of the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Epic of Gilgamesh, Beowulf. Those are all pretty much war stories, and the Odyssey is about coming home, right? And our culture is obsessed with it, and that's just a part of the fabric of who we are. And so it becomes like, okay, well, what am I bringing new to the conversation? How am I thinking about my experiences that are going to set those experiences apart as art? For me, it was never therapy for me. It was always about making art and making sense of this stuff, but not in the sense of therapy. I think people do good work in that. They're usually psychologists or psychiatrists that are trained to do art therapy. I'm not that person. For me, it's just, these are my experiences. This is the art that I've made out of those experiences, and then giving it to my reader and be like, you figure out what I'm trying to do with it. I'm a huge fan of American modernists and the way their worldview was shifted by what happened in World War I. And so a lot of their writing reflects that. And so realizing that my worldview and the way I think about things has been shifted by my experiences in Iraq, which were minimal compared to, now I'm 48 years old. I've been out of the military and working in the civilian sector longer than I was on active duty. Think about that, but it was such a momentous occasion for me that I'm still writing about it. You think about Tim O'Brien, it took him 2 books and 20 or 30 years. Carl Marlantes, it took him many years to write The Matterhorn, and it came out many years after his experiences. It takes time to process these things.
You're obviously a writer. How often, let me back up and just ask this real quick. How long have you been a writer? Your whole life?
So yes and no. When I was a kid, we didn't have a lot of extras. You know, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad was a blue-collar worker, but we always had books. And so I used to love to read. I still like to read. I fantasized in my youth that I would be a college professor maybe one day and be a writer one day. And I was like, yeah, okay, I'm a brown kid from California. That's never going to happen to me. I'm probably just going to go work a job like my dad and come home in work boots and that'll be fine. It wasn't except for the fact that the U.S. military and the Navy gave me the GI Bill and I was able to go to college. And I am now teaching at a university. I teach creative writing and publishing, and I am a writer, in fact. But I put that kind of stuff on the shelf when I became an adult and I had to go to work and I had to feed myself and my wife and my kid. But I was still writing even when I was on active duty, especially as I gained rank and I had to do like fitness reports and evaluations and all these other things. So I was still practicing putting words on a page. And then when I got out in 2010, my first TA, Allison Revis, she was teaching a class called Intro to Creative Writing. It's CRW 201 at UNC Wilmington. And I had a hole in my schedule and I needed to fill it. And I was like, oh, I used to like writing as a kid. Why not? And she was like, hey, you're pretty talented. You should do this. And I was like, nah, I'm going to go and apply for a commission in the Marine Corps. I want to go to Afghanistan. I don't have time for that. But that door closed and I was like, all right, well, I guess this is the way it's supposed to be. So between that TA, Allison, and then my TA, Josh, in getting me the two essays that got published, or the boots that got published, or the boxes essay that got published, I was like, all right, this is the way it is. So that's been since 2010.
Michael Ramos is on the line from Wilmington. He does teach writing at UNC Wilmington. He's also a veteran of 10 years. He served in the U.S. Navy and is also a veteran of the Iraq War. His new book is titled The After, A Veteran's Notes on Coming Home. And this veteran also had a son who enlisted and was a Marine. We'll ask Michael Ramos about his son on the other side. This is Due South on WUNC. Stand by. Welcome back. It's Due South on listener-supported WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi from our downtown Durham studios, speaking on the line with Michael Ramos. He is joining us from WHQR in Wilmington. He is a military veteran and also the author of The After, A Veteran's Notes on Coming Home. And an important heads up, in the next few moments, we discuss the topic of suicide. I want to transition and ask you about an essay you wrote called Hearsay. In a couple of sentences, tell us about this essay. What is hearsay all about?
So hearsay is a couple of things. One, on the Marine Corps side of the house, it's always about the Lance Corporal Network. The other branches, I'm sure, have similar underground networks. And it's all about the rumor. We also call them sea lawyers, where it's people who just hear word or gouge, and they're just like, oh, here's what I've heard. And so, but we're always hearing something from somebody else, right? And so I started thinking about this concept of when we're all out of the Navy or the Marine Corps or our branch of service, and we're all away from our friends, and then we hear about other people who have committed suicide or the way things have worked, and it's not always firsthand, right? And it's just, we're trying to catch up and like, oh yeah, so-and-so died, or oh yeah, so-and-so died. And then like me thinking as a writer, like, oh, I wonder what it was like for that person. And then also using that for my own personal struggle. So I am one of the main characters in this essay. And so at the end of the essay, when the narrator is talking about whether his friend that he talks about at the beginning, if he pulled the gun out of his mouth before he pulled the trigger because he didn't like the taste of CLP like you did, right? That ending, that's me. That was a real event. And so I was, again, thinking about, okay, suicide's a real problem. I don't want to write an essay that's basically suicide's a real problem. That's, again, not exciting to me. So how do I tell an interesting, compelling story and still get my point across? And I started off with a quote from because it worked out that way.
What is CLP?
Cleaner, lubricant, and protectant. It's like oil for firearms.
I didn't know we were maybe going to go here, so stop me if this is too much or if I'm pushing too much. You put a gun in your mouth, and you didn't like the taste of CLP, and you pulled the gun out.
Yep. And then what's really crazy is that then the school – I went to UNCW as an undergraduate and as a graduate student, and now I'm faculty there. And The program legitimately saved my life. The day I was planning on killing myself, I was in my front room and I was like, man, my wife's going to come home. I don't want her to have to see all that mess. Let me go in the shower. I grabbed my cell phone. I grabbed my pistol. I went in the shower, turned on the water. Didn't like the taste of CLP. It was making my mouth go numb. I took the pistol out of my mouth and then my phone rang and I was like, well, who is bothering me now? And so then I put my pistol down and I grabbed my phone and it was the MFA coordinator at the time who was offering me a spot at UNC Wilmington to study. And I was like, oh my gosh, I almost ended it. And now I'm going to go study creative writing.
When was that?
Would have been March of 2013.
You talk about it calmly. And comfortably. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fine. I mean, it is what it is. And it's part of the hearsay is it's also grappling with this idea that you hear something so many times that maybe you are broken, that maybe this is a problem. Maybe it would be easier if you just checked out. And it deals a lot with what you get told. And how you react to it. And because in the middle of the essay, it's like, and you never really even think about killing yourself. You're just really tired. You're just tired of struggling. You're tired of not feeling like you belong anywhere. And that's just the way it is. At least it was for me. But I didn't kill myself, so.
More of a potential release?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's more, yeah, like we always think about like it's selfish, it's this or it's that. And it's also only a Western thing that we think that way because of our Judeo-Christian values and really just our Roman Catholic values that says that suicide is taking control out of God and therefore that's why you're condemned to hell or whatever. But like you look at a lot of other ancient cultures or Eastern cultures and suicide's not the boogeyman that we think it is. That was the way they saw it. So it's really complicated. And I wanted to tackle that complication and use my own experiences for that. And then writing it in second person obviously is the way that I put that onus on you. So like when you're reading it, you're like, you, then you're starting to think me, not Michael.
I want you to select the one or two paragraphs which you think best encapsulate hearsay and read them to us, please.
Yeah. So actually I'll read the opening because I think that's pretty useful. It's note, when you see a, and it's a blank line. When you see a blank line, insert the name of a veteran you know or at least someone you care about. Only the dead have seen the end of war, Plato says. At least we think so. Because like so many things about war, we only heard about it. We heard it from a guy who knew a guy, who knew the guy whose friend knew the guy that knew the guy who heard it first. Like when we heard about blank who killed himself. We weren't there, but we found out from a Marine who heard it from another Marine who saw it on the news. And so we're left to wonder, had he had enough? Did he want to see the end of war? Or was he just tired? And then moving over a little bit. No one at TAPS told him how hard it would be. Sure, they thanked him for his service and taught him how to dress for a job interview and told him to say please and thanks and quit saying expletive so much. But they didn't tell him how much America had changed. Why would they tell an American that America was different? Didn't he live here? They didn't tell him how much he had changed. They only told him to take off his uniform and forget about the past, who he was, and try to get some rest. Transition, they say. Only he can't forget his past, and he isn't even sure he wants to, and he can't get some rest. But he goes to bed and wakes and goes to class, and he gets more and more tired. But he isn't ever really thinking about killing himself, just how tired he is. Tired of transition, tired of school, tired of being underemployed, tired of not having any money because Congress changed the terms of the post-9/11 GI Bill, and so he only has $8 left in his checking account since he's unemployed. And when he called the prior service recruiter so he could go home and get some rest, they said, thanks, but no thanks, you're old and broken, and we don't want tattooed combat vets, we want young, fresh recruits. And he isn't sure how to feed his wife and kids or pay his bills, all of which means he's failing as a man. And failure isn't good because failure in his world means death. But we don't fail. We adapt. We improvise. We overcome. But you aren't transitioning, and they keep saying transition, but you can't, so it's you, not them. And you know that failing means death, but you don't want to die. You just want some rest. But you can never really rest after that time you almost got shot in the face or that time you thought you'd been shot in the head, but it was just a comm battery knocking you unconscious. But you can't think like that. Because that's how you try to kill yourself. And you wonder how it happened. And you wonder if he just wanted to go home. And you wonder if he finally got some sleep. And you wonder if he finally knows the end of war. And you wonder, before he pulled the trigger, if he took the barrel of his pistol out of his mouth like you did, because he didn't like the taste of CLP either.
It's Michael Ramos reading his essay, Hearsay. It is one of the essays in his new book titled The After, A Veteran's Notes on Coming Home. So by design, you want the reader to think of you when they read that essay.
Yeah.
Who do you think of when you read that essay?
Oh, I think of me. I think of a lot of guys that I know that have killed themselves for very various reasons, women that have killed themselves, thinking about, like, you just get tired. And what you get tired of hearing is transition. It's something that we use all the time. And transition means to become something different or to change. And the thing is, you don't really change as a person. You don't really change. Like, once you're a warrior, once you've been to war, there's no, like, you don't go back. You don't ever come back to the civilian world, and you're not a civilian anymore. The things that we think about, know, hear, and I don't even mean like traumatic things you've seen, like not in that campy kind of way, but just the way you think about the world, you're never going to be able to unsee those things. You're never going to be able to unexperience those things. And so to say you have to transition or go backwards, what they mean by transition is go back to being a safe little civilian who we're not threatened by.
Is there a word you prefer to use? A word that you would prefer people like me use?
I thought long and hard about it, and I'm not sure I have a good word. I think one of the things that is just evolving is a better word, right? Like,
I was thinking of recalibrating. I like evolving better.
Evolving, because I'm still me, but I'm just a more improved me every day, right? Like, the things that I experienced in the war have actually made me a better citizen. They've made me a better person. They've made me more useful in the classroom and in my society. And so when you get released back to your civilian counterparts, make it count. Like, be a credit to your service, be a credit to your community. Don't be that broken vet that hates everybody and is miserable. That's not useful. But then you get out and all you hear is, oh, you must be one of those poor broken vets. Oh, are you one of those poor broken vets? And it gets old, right? Like, when I don't think I'm broken and I think I'm still useful, but then you've got people who are like, oh, poor, poor you. Like, it's, you know, or it's like, you're just not transitioning. And one of the similes I like to use is, interestingly enough, 18 to 22 is where we take most of our recruits. That's the same age that we send kids to college. When kids go to college, four-year degree, we tell that 18 to 22-year-old student, this is going to be the best time of your life. Join a frat, join a sorority, get some friends. You're going to have lifelong friends. These experiences that you have in college are going to shape your life. Isn't that wonderful? And so then the same is true of the military. Best time of your life, best friends you're ever going to have, a different type of fraternity, a different sorority, not necessarily the best friends you're ever going to have, but some serious friends that can be lifelong friends. But when we get out, when our contract's over, we're told, hey, forget all that stuff. Go find a new identity.
We're speaking with Michael Ramos, a creative writing professor at UNC Wilmington and the author of a new book of essays. I want to drop in a little context. I want to ask you what might be a throwaway question. And I'm looking at the clock and I don't have a ton of time, which is unfortunate. But I want to just, I guess, drape some painful context here before we move too far from suicide. According to the Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs at Brown University, 7,057 U.S. service members were killed in post-9/11 war operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, while there have been 30,177 suicides among service members and veterans of the post-9/11 wars. Stated another way, there have been more than four times as many suicides than there were war deaths. So if you want to respond to that, please do, but I wanted to put that in there.
No, and I think that that's pretty useful. And that's why I wrote that essay specifically and why I wrote the book, right? And it comes down to this whole, if you just quit telling us to scrap our identities and do something else, just let us build off what the service gave us. We're pretty good at figuring things out. And I think that's the thing. We want to be useful. And then when you're told you're not useful, that's, no human being likes to be told they're useless.
A few moments ago, we were chatting about writing, your history of writing. And I am curious, to what extent were you journaling when you were in the military? And to what extent have you leaned on any of those submissions, writings, as you write today?
So I did journal pretty much every day when I was in Iraq. In fact, I still have it. It's in a big green monster. Well, it's a little green monster. It's the little green notebooks that we have. They're half letter size. They're ubiquitous in the Marine Corps or in the U.S. military. And it's still in my footlocker at my house. I very rarely open it. Sometimes I'll open it for a sanity check if I'm writing something, or a fact check, more or less. But a lot of the things I haven't forgotten, and so I don't need to go back to it really a whole lot. I might have used it maybe once or twice, mostly as an object that I would nod to in a couple of these essays, but I've never actually pulled anything from there that I found useful for this book. The way the concept is, the way the narrative are, I just never needed it, but I have it.
You're a veteran. So too is your son. He enlisted on his 17th birthday.
Yep.
And he was an infantryman in the Marines.
Yep.
I don't know what my question is. I don't sense that you had any reservations of him enlisting. I sense that you are very proud of him. So I suppose my question is, having had the experiences you had, and then knowing your son, your baby boy, was going to go and embark on maybe a very different path, but under that same umbrella, a life-altering path.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like as a father?
So when I wrote these essays, he hadn't yet shipped, I hadn't struggled with a lot of it. There's one essay called 41, and he had gone to boot camp, and I started to think about it. And I reached out to a couple of my other buddies whose sons also joined the service and was like, what do you think about this? And it's one of those things where, on the one hand, yeah, I'm very proud of him. He made a decision for himself. You can't fault anybody for doing that. And then he was willing to live with the consequences. But I also knew what he would be asked of him. I understood what could possibly lay on the other side. And there were some anxious times. I'm not going to lie that there were some times where I was a little anxious about some things. Like when he... A couple of years ago, well, I guess it would have been like 4 years ago now, when Iran was sending all those drones at the U.S. Marines who were off the coast on a Mew. My son was on that Mew, and he was not engaging with the drones. That was the LAD guys, light anti-aircraft guys. I think that's what LAD stands for. They were engaging all these drone swarms, not just one or two drones, like lots and lots of drones. And my ex-wife had sent me a text message about it and was like, we need to go in there. And I'm like, you do realize that you're asking for our son to go ashore into a hostile country and do the exact same things that you and I pretty much got divorced over. Like the things that ruined your perception of me, you're asking for our son to do that. Now, I understand those costs and I'm okay with it, but maybe don't throw his life away needlessly because you are watching the news. Like, and I think that's the thing that it goes back to the service thing that you had asked earlier, right? When we understand the cost of something, we're a little bit more judicious in how we spend, right? And so if all of us have this idea of service, then we know how much something costs and we won't be so quick to throw money at a nation or troops at a nation because it's going to cost something. When it's somebody else doing the fighting for you, it costs you nothing. So for me, like I know my son made the decision that he made, and it did cause me anxiety, and I was a little stressed out because I know what could happen. But I also know that I wouldn't vote, and I would, if something happened where we were thinking about going to war, I would be on the phone with my senator being like, hey, this is a no-go for your constituents here because I've had to fight it. Now you're asking my kid to fight it. Where's your kid? I'm sure he's not fighting it. Don't go be throwing my kid away for your military-industrial complex agenda or whatever you think national security is. That's garbage.
Michael Ramos is assistant director of UNC Wilmington's PubLab, also art director for the literary magazine Ecotone, and he's the author of a collection of essays that he scribed titled The After, A Veteran's Notes on Coming Home. Michael, thank you very much for the candor and the conversation.
Thank you very much for having me. I hope I said some useful and interesting things.
You did. This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. For Leonita Inge, my name is Jeff Tiberi. Remember to find more Due South at duesouthradio.org.